Hey, everybody, welcome to the Grow Yourself Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin McNulty, and this is your personal development school of growth, where each week my guests and I will bring and break down big ideas and practices that will help you learn, grow, and succeed in life. Thanks for checking us out. Now let the growth begin. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Grow Yourself. I'm your host, Kevin McNulty. And I'm going to tell you, I was trying to think, to come up with a good title for today's topic because it's one that I absolutely love. It resonates with me. I got my issues that I may bring up and get me some therapy while I've got our guest here. But in any event, I was trying to think about a topic, and she sent me one, and it just went boom. And here's what she said. She suggested to grow yourself, know yourself. I love that, man. And so that's where we're going. You know, we're going to know yourself a little bit more and talk about these things. You know, I can tell you that this is, as I mentioned, you know, one of those episodes that that really resonates with me. And frankly, I'm going to have to work really hard to stay focused because I have many thoughts and ideas and questions around the topic. And what is the topic? Well, my guest and I will delve into the conversation around self-limiting beliefs or self-limiting thoughts, destructive patterns of negative self-talk that I think, you know, as a coach, I experienced that, but as a coach, I know a lot of people run into this idea of how they talk to themselves. So, of course, we all experience moments of self-doubt and insecurity, but when we allow the negative self-talk, if you will, to take over, it can become a major roadblock, not just to our own personal growth, but to our success and certainly to our happiness. I think it's important that the way that we talk to ourselves can have a profound impact, not only on our mental health, but our relationships, and I said, our happiness. And I know something about this. I'm just going to be very candid with you. You know, negative self-talk can lead to feelings of anxiety, depression, even physical health problems, indirectly, if you will. But I would also say, you know, by learning to recognize and challenge these negative thoughts and this self-talk, we can break free from their hold on us. And we can kind of move forward in life with more confidence, with more self-assurance. But here's the really good news. My guest is a very well-spoken expert who will, you know, help us not only understand aspects of limiting beliefs, but the power of positive self-talk and the steps we can take to overcome negative self-talk. So today, let's learn to reframe our thoughts, to shift our perspectives, to cultivate a mindset of positivity and productivity. And let this be a moment for some of you that, you know, that we begin the process of conquering our inner critic, term that I use. I'll be curious to know the term that she uses. So who's going to talk to us? Well, my distinguished guest is Dr. Betsy Holmberg. She's a good Swedish girl, I'll start off with that. But she's an award-winning psychologist specializing in overthinking and negative self-talk. Her work has been featured in Psychology Today, something I pay attention to a lot. Fast Company, another great magazine that's out there. In addition to various TV, radio, podcast appearances, she ran the mental health service line at McKinsey & Company. If you're not familiar with them, it's a big consulting company out there. It's a global consulting firm, I should say. And before that, she conducted and published research at Harvard University on non-suicidal self-injury and suicide. And so Betsy received her PhD in psychology from the distinguished Duke University, and from where she also graduated Phi Beta Kappa. It is such a great pleasure to have Dr. Holmberg with us here today. So Betsy, thank you so much for being with us on Grow Yourself.
I am so excited to be here, Kevin. I love your podcast, so it's an honor to be with you.
Oh, I appreciate that so much. You know, everybody hears this all the time. I want to know, who is Betsy Holmberg? Tell us a little bit about who you are, where you came from, and how you ended up here today.
You bet. So I am an introvert and I'm a heavy reader and have been forever. And so I went into school and ended up going into psychology because it fit everything that I was interested in. And then went out into the business world, as we talked about, mm-hmm. and decided to do something wildly different. Then got married and had a baby. And then 2 years into our marriage, my husband said, I can't do this anymore and
No
I'm out.
way.
And so went through the divorce, which is a grueling process and something I actually want to write about more in the future because I don't think our culture does enough of a job to talk about divorce as a trauma,
Very
because it's
interesting.
intense. And it was 3 years afterwards, and guys, I was still struggling. So I had been on antidepressants. They had really helped. They were wonderful. But after 3 years, I thought I should be healed. I should be done with this. Like, I've done the work. I'm a very introspective person. I feel safe now. Like, why, when I try to titrate my medication down, do all of these thoughts come up? And they're thoughts of everyone's going to think you're different because you're the divorced mom, or everyone's looking at you differently, or, it's going to be hard to date because everyone's going to think there's something wrong with you because, your husband left you. I mean, it was even the basics of my life. It was, I can't handle this. I can't handle trying to support myself and raise a child all by myself and try to give him the kind of upbringing I want to give him
Yeah.
so that he doesn't turn into a mess when he grows up,
Right.
So, I mean,
How
it
about
just was
that? Yeah.
endless. And I thought, enough. I can't handle this anymore. Like, why am I so damaged? And I literally thought, I'm going to be damaged for life. And so I went back to my roots and I went back to the academics and I went back to reading. And that's when I started to get into the neuroscience of our thoughts. And when I started to understand that, I thought, what? So this is what I'm doing. And it shifted everything for me. I started titrating off my medication immediately, and I haven't looked back. And it's really
Wow.
shifted my perspective to the point that this little introverted person is now going out in the world and talking about it, because if it could help me that much, perhaps it can help other people too, just to understand why they're thinking that way instead of just assuming that it's them and believing it.
Wow. And there are boatloads of people on antidepressants, aren't there?
Yes. It
You
is
know,
kind of our first degree treatment for
yeah.
depression and things. And this is to say it has a wonderful spot, but
Sure.
there are also other, sometimes it doesn't work, and there
Yes.
are other methods. And I think the more things we can, work with,
Yes.
the better off a person can be, the more that person will heal.
Yes, but to your point, perhaps there are many who may be on antidepressants that they just haven't figured out a way to sort out their depression or their anxiety or whatever the case might be. And and antidepressants, I think they normalize a lot of things, and people are like, okay, I feel normal this way, so I'm just going to stick it out like this, and not. I mean, you know this more than most of us. I mean, the struggle's important to become better in life, right? I mean, even struggling through depression.
It is. And funny, I have felt a double-edged sword with it, because here I was for myself wanting to get off of it because somehow I felt like it was showing that I wasn't fully right. And yet, full well knowing as a psychologist that for some people, it is fantastic to stay on a low-dose medication for the rest of their lives. And that gives them a quality of life they wouldn't otherwise have. And that is a wonderful solution. So there is a
Right.
place where I was putting the stigma on myself that I shouldn't
Right.
have been. But at the same time, I'm glad that I learned what I learned. And then, hopefully that can help
Wow.
everyone, no matter whether they're on the antidepressant, whether they're on forever, which is great, which is wonderful if it
Sure.
does improve quality of life, or if it's someone who wants to get off. Wherever you are on the spectrum, like, we're here for you.
No, that's fantastic. And I love the way that you balance that out, that because there are some who choose to stay on it and who may find it necessary, and then there are others who don't want to be medicated, and so they want to find a way to get off of this. So let me ask this. I think if we may, I want to really kind of talk about the two interrelated topics, I would say. One, the limiting beliefs, or the self-limiting thoughts, and then self-talk as well, the negative self-talk. My first question to you is, when it comes to this negative self-talk, who is talking to you?
Who is talking is an automatic brain. And this was one of the big ahas for me, is that our brain is like an old house that keeps on getting renovated. And so you put an addition on here, and then you put, some little, extra study on there, and it builds on itself. And so evolutionarily, our brain built over time. And we see this also with the other mammals. And so And so if you think about our thoughts built over time using different networks, and we have two thought networks. So the first one, this is the voice that is giving you your self-limiting beliefs. And it's called the default mode network. It was your first thought network to come online. And it served a very critical purpose in our evolution. Because as we became a kind of more community-based species, we needed a way to support that community-like behaviors. So we needed something that could look around us and understand what the norms were and follow them. We needed something that could understand hierarchy and follow hierarchy and appropriately. And because it was so primitive, it's automatic. So I think of it as its fraternal twin, the stress system, which developed at the same time. So it's, or stress system, I think, like, essentially they are both critically important at the same time. And I should say, we think about them in the same way. Like, we think of our stress system as helping us run away from a saber-toothed tiger.
Yes.
You know, we think of it as our hunter-gatherer past. Well, our default mode network, what I call our tribal brain, also developed at that time to help us stay within the clan. Because if we didn't stay within the clan, and if we didn't follow the norms, if we did something outrageous, wow, if we looked different, acted different, something, we would get kicked out and we would die. So essentially, they're wow, both trying to keep us from death, and they're both automatic. So what the brain imaging shows is, if you ask someone in an fMRI machine to focus on something, they do. And they use their more sophisticated thought network to do that. That's our central executive network. Then when that task is done, then, and they're just like, okay, hang out in the fMRI machine, this thing comes online. And it runs and it runs and it runs. And I think we all know what that experience is of having your brain run and not being able to stop it. It's because it's this, it's your tribal brain, and it's automatic, and it's trying to keep you from dying.
Wow. So in that sense, it's all about survival, isn't it? Whether that's physical survival or social survival, I guess. I mean, right?
Because social survival is physical survival. Isn't that crazy?
Yes, it is crazy.
And wow, so it's not in our head. The desire to fit in, the desire to not look different or act different, all of that actually is a sort of physical survival mechanism. It's not in our heads. It's not some weakness in us. It is something that is that is built into us in order to keep us alive.
Yet we have to figure out a way to manage all of that, because, and I would like to ask then, why do some people with negative self-talk or whatever, why do some end up in the extreme version of that it causes eventually maybe depression, anxiety, or just real problems dealing with other people, relationships, all these sorts of things? Why do people end up in this way, whereas others seem to be able to manage it better?
There is a place where, and I very much felt myself doing this, is we have these thoughts, and then I believed my thought, and I thought, okay, so what does this mean? So the fact that I feel like I can't handle this, what does that mean? Does that mean I need to make more money? Does that mean this and that? And I would start to go on it, and I would think further and further and further, and it's a negative spiral. And that's the problem with the tribal brain, is it spirals. It just keeps going. And over time, those connections in your brain get stronger. They get more, they increase. So over time, I think of it as your tribal brain starts to look like a bodybuilder. You're very used to using it. And then your central executive, which is where the thoughts you choose to have, what you choose to focus on, that starts getting weaker because you're not using it as much. And we also have a third area called the salience network, which decides which we're focused on. And so the more time we spend ruminating, the more we're teaching our salience network that those are the thoughts we care about and want to experience. And so we can get further and further and further down that hole, and it can get, and it's just think of it as a negative spiral. We go further and further. Whereas if we can start to intentionally focus our thoughts away, intentionally dismiss this tribal brain, it teaches the salience network, I don't care about those thoughts. I don't think they're valid, and I don't want to listen to them. And bizarrely, you'll start to hear them less, and they'll get less intense. they'll get less serious, which is strange, but yeah. True. It starts to think about, oh, I'm hungry. I wonder if that brownie is still there. Like, it'll start to get stupider. I mean, it's still survival. It's still food, you know, it's still eating,
yeah.
But it's stupid survival. It's not the kind of survival that breaks our hearts.
Oh, wow. So now, then there's this idea of self-limiting thoughts, or other people say limiting beliefs. I suppose they're one and the same to a degree. I mean, thoughts and beliefs are different, but in any event, what are those? Explain that from your perspective. What are self-limiting thoughts?
So a self-limiting thought is any sort of thought that, you know, will hold us back. And if we think about this tribal brain in terms of how it first developed, is its whole goal was to see what the clan norms were. And so it sees the clan, it picks up clan norms from everywhere in our society. And this is where minority groups or LGBTQ plus individuals, like they like in our society, there's going to be data for them that, you know, you are not as worthy. You are, you know, you're not the same as everyone else. And this tribal brain will hold on to that and then play that back to you because it thinks it's keeping you safe. It thinks the more that it tells you, like, hey, you're out of line there. Hey, that's not right. Hey, you're different. Like, you're not successful enough. You need to get better. The more it says that, the more it thinks it's keeping you safe. And it can be very damaging for us to feel. So this is to say that limiting beliefs can come from experiences we have out in the world. But the thing is what happens is then this tribal brain takes that and is like, there's your clan norm. And it will constantly repeat it back to you to try to somehow, like, I guess, alert you. I think of it as like a vigilance system, yeah. Alert you of like, this is a place where you can get kicked out and make you feel bad.
Yeah.
And so that's where understanding it and it's so helpful to be able to say, you know what, I'm dismissing it. Like, sure, there is a lot of clan, you know, there's a lot out there that women don't earn as much, women don't do that, but am I really going to listen to that? No. And so that's when we can start to take that action role, that choice role, and say, I'm dismissing it. I'm not taking that as true. I'm not creating beliefs around it. And if I hear it, I'm not going to make more of it than what it is, which is just an automatic thought.
I love the way you say that. That is so important because, you know, you think this reminds me of a scenario, and I hope I can make this connection correctly. So I spent I spent 20 years in the Air Force after 20 years or 19 years in a military family. So essentially 40 years in this very structured military family. I get out in 2000, my wife and I move here. I'm going to start a speaking and coaching business, and she's going to start something else. And the anxiety that went behind that is just off the charts. And that's a whole different story. But for many years, I had super anxieties about my business. I mean, I can't tell you the number of times that I would almost have panic attacks in the middle of the night thinking, what if in 3 months, my business crashes or nobody wants to engage me? I mean, I would start having these thoughts constantly. And I'll never forget, though, Betsy, that one night it was so overwhelming. I decided, you know, and here's a person, you know, I'm not a psychologist as you are and don't have that level of expertise, but I've studied these things for many years. I mean, since the 80s, I was studying personal development, all these things that surround, but not probably in the same way that you did. So my point is I was pretty self-aware. I understood a lot of these concepts, but still couldn't handle a lot of them, control a lot of this thing going on. So I remember laying in bed one night, and the anxiety was so overwhelming. I think it was actually right around after COVID started. So it was this not that long ago. And I just couldn't take it. And I finally said to myself, Kevin, you can't do this. You can't lay here at 3 o'clock in the morning just stressing out of your mind. And I literally am talking to myself in my head saying the following. Okay, here's the question for you, Kevin. Are you going to get up right this very moment and go do something about what you think is stressing you out? And the answer was, and I literally answered myself, said, no, I'm not going to do it. I'm tired. I just can't. I'm not going to do it. Okay, then just drop it. And I did. And it never hit me again. It never happened again.
Good for, so that was you intentionally choosing to like, I'm not going to listen to it. And if we look from an evolutionary perspective at what you were doing, like it makes complete sense. Because if we're a communal species and here you are going off on your own, developing your own business, hoping other people will start to kind of try to clan with you, you know, and like, and
Interesting.
you know, you're like,
Yes.
you're essentially trying to create your own clan, but how life-threatening that would be to a hunter-gatherer to go off and do that. So of course your anxiety was huge, and of course your mind was racing all the time because this was probably threw off every single alert that your tribal brain had to say, you're not going, this is not safe. And honestly, I think nighttime is the worst. And my tribal brain still goes nuts in the nighttime. It makes me laugh. I'm like, here you are, the freaking expert on this, and you cannot control it. And like, because, and there's a part that I think makes sense with that though, because that was our most vulnerable time that we could have, you know, you can't see, it's dark out. You know, that was a very threatening time to be alive. Just hoping you probably made it through the night and something didn't eat you, some night predator. So I think we all are kind of a little more amped up at night anyways, and it's that immobile feeling, and being immobile can be very scary. Like that brings out all of our, like from a polyvagal perspective, all of our autonomic stress response from being immobile. And yeah, and all of our minds run and we're all doing it. And it's just enough to drive you nuts.
I have never heard of it the way that you just explained it, and it just lays in my brain so nicely. Honestly, it does. Because when you talk about it from this sort of a hunter-gatherer, the survival state, the things that go on top of it relate to it well. I had a 1-year-old and 3-year-old girl. My wife was going into her own business, so we didn't have this like serious income coming in. And all of that goes to the point that you're making here, that all of this is threatening to our survival. And as a quote hunter-gatherer, if you will, all of that, which I didn't think about at the time, was going, wow, my whole clan could fall apart if I don't get this right. And then it just digs deeper, spirals, right? Spirals more.
Exactly.
How
Exactly. And
interesting.
I think that the thing with psychology, what I think our field has gotten wrong for a really long time is we make it all mysterious and mystical, and like there's this deep soul of ourselves and we have to process who it is and talk to it. And I kind of feel like that's not right. And I hate to say like the entire field is wrong, but you know what? I think this is what humans do with things we don't truly understand. Is we do make them out to be bigger and more magical than they really are. When a lot of times, but there's also a great relief with that because I used to spend all this time, oh, I need to know myself. I need to understand myself. I need to, like, you know, and really process it all. And it was such a relief to be like, you know what? I actually don't, like, this is just an evolutionary thing. It's happening to me. Like,
Yeah,
I
no, I
can just
actually
dismiss
don't.
this, you know?
Oh, wow.
And who I am is not all of this mumbo jumbo processing. Who I am is actually the one that's present right now, the one that's aware of my world right now, the one that loves certain things like you know, like you love golden, so I love my shih tzu, I love my kid. Like that's really me, you know, not this psycho mumbo jumbo that goes on in my tribal brain all the time.
That's very interesting you're saying that. I remember having a conversation just recently about a person, about, no, not with a person, about this idea that some people we see on, and I want to ask you about this, about emotions and the role that it plays or how that all works together. But that, as we look in social media and see, so much divisiveness and so much anger and just outrage. And I was talking to this person. I was saying, the interesting thing about it is that, that could be your neighbor next door that you get along with really, really well and that you like so much. But something happens on the internet when all this negativity comes around and there's this fight. People have taken positions, and people get emotional. And this notion that, again, it could be just easily that neighbor that's right next to you. You think they're just the best person, the most chilled, but once the emotions get involved, it's a whole different game. So I want to ask you about that, about the role of emotions in all of this sort of thing, including self-talk and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so let's do both of those because
Please.
to describe what happens. So think about when you're on social media and how passive it is. You know, it's sitting back and it's scrolling. So we are all in our tribal brains when we're on social media. And of course, we're
Interesting.
doing what the tribal brain does, which was compare. This is how it figures out if it's safe. It's constantly comparing you to everyone else. And how am I doing? Am I doing okay? And everyone, of course, looks amazing on social media. So we feel bad about ourselves. So psychologists talk about the default mode network or the tribal brain as the seat of social emotional awareness and moral awareness.
Interesting.
So this is where we get our sense of right and wrong. And there was a, like, whatever the clan thought was right, you follow and you get behind. And
Wow.
what happens is you're on social media, you're in your tribal brain, you are not looking at news articles from a factual perspective. We're not critically thinking about what we're reading. We are looking at it from a moral place. And as we are all in our little algorithms, and also the content is so emotionally based, we are seeing it as a right and wrong. We start to see issues that really require critical thinking, like politics,
Wow.
as moral issues, as right and wrongs. And so we lose all sense of truth and we get very emotional. It's because emotions
Wow.
go, and so this leads into your second part on how does emotions play in. So emotions shut down our more evolved thought process, our what we choose to think. So our central executive network, it shuts it down. I think of it in inventory terms. This is where I get back to consulting. So it's like the last in, first out. So that's an inventory. Like the last product to come into the factory is then the first one to get shipped out. And that's true in your brain. So the last thought network to come online, your central executive, is the first to come out. And then the one that actually stays is the one that was been around, has been around for, tens of thousands of years to help us survive, which is our tribal brain. So we get even more stuck in it because that's the body's way of staying safe. And emotions do it. Fatigue does it. When you're tired, it will shut down your central executive network, and stress will do it.
I.e., your critical thinking, right? You're
All
thinking,
your critical
rational
thinking
thinking,
goes.
and
And it's your choosing thinking. That's the thing. What do you choose to think about? And so that's why it feels like you can't shut this brain off
Wow.
because the salience network has essentially shut down any chance that you can get into choosing what you want to think. And so we're kind of along for the ride. And knowing this, it helps because you're like, oh, okay, I know I'm exhausted and my tribal brain's going. I'm hearing what it's saying, but I'm not going to give it any credit. And what I'm finding living this myself, because we're all human, we've all got this hardware,
Yeah.
is then the whatever the stress is or whatever the emotion is, it doesn't last as long as it used to. Because I did dismiss it, because I didn't give it meaning, I didn't ruminate, I didn't continue to ruminate after the stress was gone and my central executive went online, came back online. Like I actually I it stays littler than if you don't know this and you start to really believe whatever it is that is going on.
I've heard. Psychologists and others say that, yeah, that sometimes when you have these thoughts, that you shouldn't fight them one way or the other, that you shouldn't contribute to them, nor should you really try to, fight them, because fighting them is lending energy to it. Is that, do you agree with that?
You know, it's funny because I totally heard that too. And I
Yeah.
was like, yeah, okay, that makes sense. But when you're in the moment and you're having the thought, you feel that it's somehow helping you. Like I
Interesting.
always felt that like if I was thinking, oh, I can't handle this, that somehow that was actually a productive thought. And I think that inner sense of like this is productive actually comes from the fact that it is a survival network. So
Very
back then it
interesting.
actually was productive.
I
And
see.
so it's only understanding really what it was that helped me get to that place that psychologists tell us we all should be, which is to let it come, let it go. I couldn't do it until I knew what it was.
Very interesting. So, yes, but yeah, it seems to me though that you're thinking a little bit more rational and critical about it and objectively, if you will, than to just like have a fight with your negative thoughts or something like this, where it's just more anger that you're putting on top of it.
See, I actually hate that. That's the center. That's the cognitive behavioral therapy approach. That's the, no, we need to be dismissing these thoughts. And why the fighting the thought doesn't work and replacing the thought doesn't work is because this is a vigilance system. So if you fight that one thought and replace it, well, your tribal brain will come up with something else because it's constantly trying to keep you safe.
Interesting.
So to me, that is not an effective way for people to get true lasting change.
So tell me then one more time, what is the to-do there?
The to-do is to understand it and dismiss it and not to fight it. Not to be like, I'm going to replace it with this positive thought. Well, okay, that's fine. But then this is where I feel like the further with therapy, the further you get in the rearview mirror, like the less effective it can feel sometimes. It's because, you know, it's this vigilance system has kept going and it's given you new things. And then if you believe them, they're really going to affect your life.
So that now makes sense, what you said earlier when I was talking about this 3 o'clock in the morning thing that I had, that I just had this sort of a chilled, at some point, this chilled discussion about what it was and what I was going to do about it, and made a decision. As you said, I chose to that, you know, and it did. It literally went away. I don't know even at what point that I said, wow, I haven't had those thoughts anymore about, you know, that. And I didn't really fully understand how it worked, and you just explained it. May I ask also about confirmation bias and negative self-talk? Do we tend to do that as well, that when we have these negative thoughts and we talk to ourselves, is that part of the spiraling process that you somehow want to confirm that what you're thinking is true, that you suck, you know, or something? I don't know.
So like essentially you're looking in the outside world then for confirmation that
perhaps or even
you have?
Or, yeah, perhaps, or just the I suppose, or maybe even other more thoughts or more evidence that what you're thinking is, yeah, see, I told you were not this, or I don't know.
So I think of the tribal brain as that super overeager, like second grader that tries to answer every single question before the teacher's even finished saying the question, you know, like she wants to answer before the question's even been said. I mean, it's just it's constantly wanting to try to understand you in the context of your environment. And so, yeah, it's going to look for every single data point it can to confirm whatever it has created for you. And the thing to know with this thought network is it's primitive. Like, so it really does really basic thoughts. So it will label you like you're stupid, or, you know, you're too fat, or this or that. It will use those labels to try to understand you and what it needs to be doing. And it will also do all of this comparing, like she's prettier, they're more successful. That, I mean, this is the level of what this brain is. And it doesn't get any more complicated or sophisticated than that. And so if it has a label that it's attached to you, and it will be very happy to see it, that being confirmed either in the outside world or from some other thought, because it's trying to make that sense of the clan, and it's built this worldview. And so, yeah, sure, it's going to be happy if that worldview is confirmed. And it is for us then, as we are actually the chooser to decide, like, what clan do we want, you know, and what beliefs do we want to have? And I mean, here's actually where I get to, and I don't know where this would go, but like, do we need to have any beliefs in the first place? What purpose does a belief serve? Does it matter? You know, I mean, does it do anything? And like, there is a place to get to where we get rid of all beliefs, because that's not actually the experience of life, of being with each other in this moment with this weather. Like, I don't know.
I see where you're going. At first I was like, oh, I don't know, because, you know, I happen to be a Christian, and so I have these beliefs about my spirituality or my religion, and so that was my first thought. And then I said to myself, yeah, but I don't know. I'm confusing myself.
Well, think about it. Think about it, like, about beliefs about yourself. Like, do you need the belief you're smart? What does that really help?
Good point.
Do we need the belief that we are like, I don't know, that we are unworthy? Does that really help? Like, none
Oh,
of this
that's
is very
interesting.
true to what the actual experience of life is. And think about, I feel like when you see beliefs, even nice ones like that, like I'm really smart. Well, when that person fails, then they're going to have a real emotional response to that and really struggle because it goes against their beliefs. So is there a place where we can start to live beliefless and then therefore live more authentically and really to what our experience as being a human on this crazy planet is really about?
I got to tell you, Betsy, in the many decades that I have lived, I have never, ever heard that. Whether we should have beliefs or not. I mean, I've never heard that question. And this is not a pushback. This is a complete fascination in that question. I don't.
It's funny because
have
I've
an
never
answer.
Really thought. I never really thought about it this way before this conversation either. I have not written that anywhere like
fascinating.
That. Yeah, but like that's. I think where I've come to in this work is like, yeah, all of those are meaningless and unessential to my being really present in this life. I mean, you think of what we really want to be doing. Do we want to be helping people? That's not a belief. That is a purpose. That is meaning.
Interesting.
You know, it's different what we want to attach ourselves to.
I could see some real debate over that. You know, listen, if you've got the energy, that might be your next PhD. Let me just say that, okay? You know,
yeah, it would
if
be
you're
interesting
willing
to go
to
into
do
that
that.
more.
That's fascinating. It's fascinating. Very, very fascinating. Okay, so one more question, and I'd love to get into a few more to-dos, if you will. So the ego, where does the ego come in all of this sort of thing?
So I personally think this is the end of ego. I think this was the way we, ego was the way we conceptualize the tribal brain. And it's, you know, before we actually saw the science, before we saw the neural networks, before we saw how they all interacted, before we saw what they do under stress situations or tired situations, we came up with these metaphors, and the ego was our metaphor for that part of ourselves that looks inward and tries to keep ourselves safe and tries to protect ourselves. And I think from a scientific perspective, we've moved past the concept of ego.
Okay. Now this is the second thing I've never heard before. You're just over here blowing my mind. And by the way, all these wows and all these, that's truly authentic. I mean, you're just absolutely blowing my mind with some of your ideas and thoughts there. So then are you saying that the thinking is that the ego is not a real thing?
I think it's that you could say that the ego is the tribal brain. You could say it is the part of you that is the inward directed and protective part of you. I do think there is a place where the concept of ego is very helpful in a therapeutic setting in terms of helping people, especially people who are overgivers and are constantly saying yes to everything. And the ego is the concept of protecting the self. But again, it's just a concept. I mean, the reality is this more evolutionarily and scientifically based side of this default mode network that runs all the time, that's very critical. This is your inner critic, which is a very great term. We use it in therapy all the time. IFS uses it, trauma uses it. Like inner critic is a perfect term. And then, you know, our central executive, which really is what we choose to focus on. And so, I would do away with it entirely if I had to.
Well, I get that. And when you said, when you kind of called it a metaphor, I kind of thought, yeah, I mean, it really, you know, whatever your scientific beliefs are about the ego, I can see it as a metaphor, something that I can use. Because I talk about ego in my coaching, about the idea of people, you know, of how it affects how they interact with others, you know, that, or how they try to protect themselves. They walk into a meeting and they're late and they think everybody's, you know, looking at them and saying things, but really nobody is. That's their ego having a conversation. Oh, they're all looking at me. Oh, I'm late. I'm shameful. It looks stupid. When maybe none of that's actually happening. And so that they're sort of, their ego steps out in front of them before they have a chance to, as maybe you would put it, rationally think about this, you know, is it really happening? You know?
Yeah, you could see it as being late is
Interesting.
potentially a threat because you
Yes.
didn't do quite what the clan was at. Everyone else showed up on
Yes.
time and you didn't quite do it. And so you're like, am I going to get kicked out? And it's
Yes.
probably that too.
Yes, I mean that what you're saying here really resonates. To me, it just lays perfectly in my head. This whole attachment to how that again, the tribal brain and how it's like you said, it's ancient and I forgot the word you used. Maybe it was ancient. In envy. Okay, so the inner critic. Tell me about the inner critic. It's all related here. You're kind of talking about the inner critic, right? When we talk about self-talk and this sort of thing. But tell our audience more about that.
So the concept of the inner critic is used in internal family systems as that part of you that is thinking it's keeping you safe by essentially, being mean to you. So we've come up with a lot of ways of looking at the inner critic. And one thing I think I'd like to speak about with the inner critic is when you're watching your own, check how much it cares about how other people see you. So my
Say that one more
personal,
time.
so think about with the inner critic is how often is what it's saying somehow about how you think other people are perceiving you.
Interesting.
Here's my example from my everyday life here. So at pickup at school, everyone hangs out and waits, and there are people that wait in groups. And sometimes you talk with someone who tends to be in a group. And often what I found as I was starting with this work was I would spend my entire time talking to this mom that I thought was a very cool mom. AKA, here's my tribal brain. Like they're cool.
They're cool. I'm with you.
AKA, I'm not, but they are. It's always comparing.
Interesting.
And so I'd be
Yes.
like, okay, is she having fun in this conversation? Is there someone she'd rather be talking to? Am I interesting enough? Am I saying something? And so this tribal brain would be going nutsy. And what really made me laugh is it was perseverating on what her tribal brain was thinking of me. You know what I mean?
Oh,
On like
yeah.
Yeah, so like we spend all this time worrying about the automatic reactions of someone else, but they're going to have those automatic reactions based on how they were raised, based on what they care about, based on what they're nervous about. So there is no way we can control their automatic reactions, like if they're
Right.
enjoying their time with us or not. And so just shutting it down and saying, you know what, I don't want to listen to that and I want to be quiet and just actually be in the conversation, I ended up having a way better time because I didn't bring in all of these dynamics that are all created from my tribal brain being scared.
Well, it's fascinating that you say that because it almost can be a self-fulfilling prophecy from the standpoint that if I'm having a conversation with you and I'm so focused on this self-talk and all of and the critic and this whether she what she's doing, she's cool, I'm not cool. Well, I end up maybe looking like an idiot because I'm simply not paying attention. I'm
Exactly.
busy thinking about wow.
And the weird part is I part of me believes that we were right. I mean, like we all of this all developed when we lived in clans, and our clans science shows got up to about 150 people. So we would interact with the same 150 people for our entire lifespan. And suddenly now we are interacting with people that are not part of our clan, or they're kind of part of our clan. We don't have a clan anymore, really,
Not really.
And so it is kind of glitching our tribal brain
Yeah.
because it doesn't know where it stands. It doesn't know this person. I mean, that is a very threatening and scary thing for a tribal brain to do, is just go into a social situation and be like, hey, here I am, and feel confident. Like, I don't think anyone's tribal brain is very good at doing that because we were never designed to interact with so many different people all the time in quick little spurts. No, we were designed to, connect, work together, build each other up, be there for each other. I mean, we were really designed to be close and
Yes.
to rely on each other. And so this whole like light social world is a real struggle.
I was just thinking that our becoming a more civilized people and being more sophisticated in our thinking and our understanding. Like, for instance, I was just thinking, okay, you know, back in the day, as part of the tribe, yeah, you might just get kicked out of the tribe and you know, fed to the wolves or whatever the case might be. But then we've become more aware of love, for instance. And I mean, I couldn't hardly ever conceive of kicking one of my kids out of the clan, out of love. You know, it no matter. I don't know. It would have to be so extreme and over such a period of time that I just became numb to it, I suppose. But right, we become more sophisticated with these concepts of love and sentiment and whatever.
Well, that is unconditional love. And I
Yes.
hear you. And I think there's a place we would never kick our kids out. It
Right.
just because that is coming from a completely different part of us. That's coming from our
Interesting.
heart. And there actually are nerve cells around the heart. And I mean, who knows where we will go in terms of I'm going deep in my research now on trying to understand how those nerve cells innervate the brain and where kind of those connections are, because to me, your loving self is more your true
Wow.
self. That's who you really
I'm
are,
with you there. That's
right?
incredible.
And it's not this like thinking, no, it's not that brain. It is your heart. It is what you love. It is where you derive your meaning. Like that's who you really are. And when the more we live from that place, that's living authentically. And that's when we start to feel really good because we're not living in a kind of coping, vigilant, survival way. We're truly embodying ourselves. And that's when we start to
Wow.
really feel good and rubber hits the road.
Man, this is just so cool. I want to ask you, so maybe start to get into some things that might help me and others. But before that, I want to ask about, so somebody that has this just really aggressive and egregious inner critic, if I can say it in those terms, that it came from somewhere, if it's at such a level, correct? I mean, we probably all have some form of an inner critic, I suppose, based on what you said, the tribal brain or whatever the case might be. But then there are those. And listen, I've experienced this. I make no qualms about the fact that I've lived for many, many years with a very evil inner critic. I would say in my maturity, I've worked on it, I've worked hard on it, and it's better. But I can still go there sometimes. It just depends on, you know, how difficult things get at a given time. And it usually catches me off guard. But having said that, I've worked very hard on my inner critic. Having said that, therein lies part of the key is I had to work really, really hard to get a hold of that thing. And I can probably trace back to a few places in my life, early in my life, that it probably came from as a child, if you will. The question is, that I want to ask you is it necessary that the people listening who may have a very strong inner critic, is it necessary they figure out where it came from?
It depend it depends.
Okay.
So if you are someone who tries to do all the mindfulness meditation stuff and it is very jarring and it's very hard and you feel very and it feels very flary, then it might be that often what we need to do is be able to express whatever that experience was.
I
So if
see.
we have something that we have held down and that we haven't shared, and we haven't brought to the light of day. I mean, there is a place where trauma work would actually really help. And
I see.
EMDR is the type of therapy to look at that does this kind of trauma work. Because what you find is that if you have experienced a trauma, funny enough, the
Yeah.
default mode isn't even online. Your tribal brain isn't even
I
online.
see.
The whole brain shuts down. And what happens is trauma then gets coded almost just as the snippets of the experience. And it's never made into a memory, and none of these thought processes are part of it. And so that's where we can have flashbacks, it can reactivate. And so there's a part of, and then an inner critic can,
PTSD, yes.
exactly. And so an inner critic can come in because it's hard to manage this. And so your tribal brain will start to really rail on you for it. And that's like the worst possible thing, right? So
Wow.
for some people, doing that work and going back and talking it through and then talking through those snippets of experience to then integrate them into a memory so they can be stored as a memory. it can be incredibly helpful and can make then the flashbacks go away, or you know, those really triggering like high anxiety moments, like the panic attacks, it can make those panic attacks go away. So there's very much a place. This is to say too, which I think is really interesting, is this tribal brain was never meant to operate in isolation, which I think is part of the trouble of modern day society. So if we did something egregious, we had our clans members right there to say, that's wrong. And you'd be like, oh, okay. And you'd see it in their face and you'd get the criticism. And then it would learn, okay, that's not the norm. And what's kind of going off the rails for us nowadays is that we aren't getting those feedback backs of like, or if we're beating ourselves up, like I'm really feeling low, we don't have that in-person one-on-one interaction saying, no, you're doing great. You know, we use each other. We are a communal species. We use each other to temper the tribal brain either way. And so since we don't have that as much, we have people really going to crazy extremes on social media. Yeah. You know, I mean, they're saying just unbelievably awful
it's
things.
Amazing. Yes.
That is a tribal brain without guardrails, you know, without social guardrails. And we're doing the same with ourselves, and we're having suicidal ideation.
Yeah.
And so talking with people, sharing your story and finding that community can be incredibly healing for individuals.
But we're seeing evidence of that tribal brain thing in real life too, right? I mean, it's more and more. I mean, maybe I think it's more and more. I don't think it's just because we're seeing it on the internet and able to see it more. I mean, there are more people just acting wholly inappropriate, if you know, maybe that's my tribal brain saying that, in some store or the shootings, you know, all these sorts of things. There seems to be people that are just lashing out, if you will. Am I making the right connection here?
You are 100% making the right connection.
Interesting.
Yeah. And it's because we are living more from this brain and being online. So just as like a side note, so a lot of the things that used to work our central executive network, like doing mental math or trying to figure out your way that you were driving to get to whatever the new restaurant was, those were all things that used our central executive network and built it up and made it strong. And so many of those tasks, balancing your checkbook, all of those have moved online and are just done for us, further weakening our central executive network. And then we're spending more time in our tribal brain. It's strengthening our tribal brain.
Boy.
And so we're becoming more reactive. We're becoming more violent. We're becoming almost more the cavemen, you know, that we, you know, we used to be, except for without those same social constraints of people, you know, keeping us in line.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it does explain where we've come with our society. Technology's had a huge role.
Yes, I believe that. And I'm going to say before I forget it there, Dr. Holmberg, you need to get yourself out there more, because people need to hear what you're saying here. It just, when you said that, I was like, it all makes sense. And I might argue, I don't know if you'll debate me about or push back about this or not. So therefore, the tribe and the tribal brain, our understanding of how society acts, is also important, correct? I mean, you're not going to go into a library and start screaming because people be like, shh, you know, or maybe not anymore. I don't know. I haven't been in a library in a minute. But the idea is that, you know, the tribe is important, whether it be the family or the neighborhood or the community or the society, right? That we have to grapple with that.
It's hugely important. And it's also, what is our tribe feeding back to us? And so this is part of like what these algorithms have done is the algorithms focus on the highly emotional and like, you know, enraging content. You know, this is the Tucker Carlson phenomenon, essentially. And so it is making us feel that from a clan perspective, it is appropriate to be enraged. It is appropriate to be violent. I mean, this is the January 6th insurgency, you know, and our tribal brains are so quick to follow whatever the clan does that then, okay, violence is acceptable. Let's do it now because, you know, Trump said it so, you know, and so, yeah, I think the more we know about this, then we can start, we need to be looking at our world, our climate and politics and everything from a critical thinking perspective. And we're all stuck in our tribal brains and we're really at an impasse.
Algorithms might be analogous to neuropaths, right?
Yes.
that it's, if I get it right, it's kind of the same thing as that. If you're watching something, the algorithm picks up and sends you more and then more and then more and then more. And you keep digging that hole until you've built this solid belief behind what you're seeing over and over and over. I mean, I don't know if that's the right idea there, but in any event, it just flashed in my head about that. Okay, wow. Where do we go from here? This is so fascinating. Okay, so then somebody that has self-limiting thoughts or limiting beliefs about themselves, they have this critic that's overly critical about them. Now what? What do people do about this that are struggling with it? You know, and by the way, I would submit to you that I'm almost of the belief that most of us, at least, if not all of us, should have a therapist sometime in our life, you know, just somebody to talk to or a coach or something like this. I will tell you, I meant to say this before, that this whole connection to childhood. I saw a therapist one time, and just as we were talking about things that were ailing me emotionally or mentally, she latched onto this idea that my mother had passed when I was 16, and very suddenly, and there was five of us, five kids in the house. It was very sudden. And so any of it, as I talked about things that I experienced through my life, you know, post my mother's death, she came to this conclusion. She said, "Kevin, you never said goodbye to your mom, did you?" I'm getting choked up just saying that. And I thought to myself, because we had a very, very good relationship, I thought to myself, you know what? No, I didn't, actually. My life moved on so quickly after that, which don't need to get into the whole discussion, but I didn't even have time to really think about it that much. But no, I didn't say goodbye to her. So, I mean, but you think how that then can, I'm going back to that place of asking, you know, do people need to know from whence a problem or a critic came from. And when she said that, I said to me, I can see why that would bug me my entire life. Yeah. If I didn't understand that I never said goodbye. And she encouraged me to sit down and write a letter.
I love that. And, you know, I think where that is so powerful is because when we believe that this tribal brain voice is ourself, that this inner critic is us, then we need those other people to play it off of and have them, because they're not, I think this is so interesting about human dynamics. They, if they're really listening, they're not in their inner critic. And also they're only cared about their own. This is a vigilance system for them about their survival. So when you're sharing your stuff with them, they're not looking from a vigilance perspective. They're not looking from a survival perspective like you are. They're looking from their central executive. They're bringing their whole selves. They're looking from their heart, right? And so they're really able to look at you and think, what's going to help? And how are you going to feel better? And like, and think about it like she did, like, wait, you never said goodbye. And because you're so stuck in your inner critic, and when we believe that voice is ourselves, we're even more stuck, you know, it can really shock us out of it. And it can be so helpful to have someone else to talk about with this stuff.
Wow, that's the simple concept of, you know, looking from the outside in. You know, this is the value of a therapist and a coach and a good friend that you can take to them. And but this also explains then, this is so fascinating, folks. I hope you're listening, because, like, for instance, I coach tennis on the side a little bit. You know, I coach a middle school tennis team and this, that, and the other. I coached both of my daughters, but I think I ruined them for life because, you know, and along the way, other people saying that I'm coaching my kid or something, I'm saying, don't do that unless you are really in control. And now I will put this in your language, unless you can work from your executive brain, don't do it. Because when they gave me an attitude, or when I thought they weren't trying hard enough, I was operating from the tribal brain, wasn't I? And this explains why it doesn't work for
everyone. And they're operating from their tribal brains too. And you are the hierarchy, and you are telling them they're not living up, and they feel completely defeated and like, yeah.
And it's why when I turned them over to another coach, I would say to that coach over on the side, I've told them that a million times, and they wouldn't believe me. And that's why they can do it, because it's a whole different brain relationship.
Yeah. The one thing I've noticed, because I've felt the same way with my kid, like, don't do it. And this conversation actually is showing me from a tribal brain perspective exactly why. But he loves math, and he loves math problems. I thought, I don't want to be teaching him. But in first grade, he's not learning what he wants to be learning. And so it's a game. I'm like, here, I've got a puzzle for you. And he's like, ooh. And so when we turn it into a game, it takes off all of those dynamics.
Yes.
But that's the only way I can do it. Or we're reading other people's books, because, yeah, we don't want to get into anything tribal when it comes to our loved ones. We want them to feel safe. We want them to feel perfect, exactly who they are. This is also what's so hard about adolescence, is in adolescence, they feel so much that, you know, they have to achieve, they have to get A's, they have to get into the right college. And so they believe their identity is going to be based on their achievements. And that's where it's so important for us as their family is to say, you're perfect no matter what happens. Like, I love you no matter what. You're going to be safe no matter what. Yes. You will find a way. And I know it doesn't seem it, because it seems like unless you go to the perfect school, your life's going to be over. But it's actually really not true. And you're going to be great no matter what. And like, that's the message we need to be imparting on them.
Yeah, that's incredible.
Hope they get it.
So, so just real quick, because I've kind of got lost in this conversation. Don't even know how long we've been going here. You're terrific, by the way. I'm just going to say, Betsy, you're just absolutely terrific. I love the way you pull all of this together and these ideas. So just about self-limiting beliefs or self-limiting thoughts, the inner critic, you know, where do people start? Where does the average person start to, if you want to say, heal themselves or to improve, if you will, you know, just get a little bit better with that?
Yeah. So two quick ways. There are two. I've noticed with my clients, there are two ways that people like to handle this. One is to identify it. And when they see it, you essentially label it back. And you're like, okay, what is this thing doing? You can say, is it comparing me? Is it labeling me? And, or is it measuring something? I need to lose 5 pounds. Like, I need to make $100,000. Like, what is this thing? And so if you label it back, that's you going into your central executive, because you are working through what you think of it. The other thing to do is to do, it's a dog training technique, which is move the dog. So your inner critic, your tribal brain, thinks it's the alpha, and it thinks it's running you. And what you need to do is to say, you know what, I'm alpha, and to make it go away. And the way you can shift your focus is literally, guys, you focus on anything. You focus on the color of the sky. You focus on a blade of grass. And what you're going for is to get to that place where your inner thoughts stop. And when you focus that hard, that it's actually still, you know, you've gotten there. You know, you're in your central executive, because they're like a light switch. They're either or. So you're either in one or you're in the other. And so bizarrely, if I'm in a really bad spiral, I will watch TV. And I used to think that that was a bad coping mechanism. I now know it's great, because it's distracting me and focusing my attention away from this awful voice in my head. Right. Okay.
But do you go back to it at some point and deal with it, though, whatever it's talking about?
You don't have to. You dismiss it. Okay. That's the crazy part. You fully dismiss it. You're like, oh, I don't want to be there. There's nothing productive happens in my tribal brain. I just want to get out of it. I call a friend, focus on their life. That can help. What's going on with you? Tell me about you. You know, just whatever you can do to focus your attention elsewhere. Another thing that other people like, if they have struggle with this refocusing, some people really resonate with the concept of, you know, how a TV is going on in the background, and how when you shut the TV down, you're like, ah. Well, some people like the concept of, this is your internal television, and it's just in the background, and it's just going all the time, and you kind of try to block it out. You try to dismiss it, like you dismiss a television going on in the background. I even think of it as the Real Housewives of me. Like, it's literally a Real Housewives episode in my head going all the time, and just shut it off. So some people like that concept of just hearing it, like Charlie Brown's teacher, like, rah, 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 you just, you know, is just not focusing on it and like thinking through it and keep believing it. You just see it as that rah, rah voice.
It's a
It gets
separate
you out.
entity than you. It's something different that you, that as you're saying that, and if you think about it that way, then you realize you can shut it down. So if you think it's part of who you are, then you don't think you can get rid of it, right? Or
Yes.
shut it down, I guess you could say.
Yes. This is, you fully know it's not. Either you see it as a television, you see it
Wow.
as an alpha, you see it as, I mean, people love metaphors and metaphors work. Like, I think of
I
also
do too.
another one is I'm the CEO of myself. I have some fantastic employees. My eyeballs are amazing. I love, my ears, but I have this employee that sits in my office all day long and whines and complains about how they're not getting any credit and they're not good enough. And it's up to me to say, you need to go back to your cubicle and I need to shut the door and then move on with what I care about in my life and not let this annoying employee take over my entire day.
Wow.
So it's whatever metaphor
Yes.
works, but whatever it is that ha like whatever works for you, like to get out of it and refocus elsewhere is
So
great.
you're just saying straight up to dismiss it, and the more that you do that, the less than it the then almost like that employee that nags you, they will not come back nagging you at some given point.
Yeah, well, you know what? Bizarrely, they will because it's a vigilant system. We're all
Okay.
stuck with it. So you'll get tired. And like, so now, I get really worried that like, my kid's going to have something awful happen. My parents are going to die. I'm going to get really sad. I mean, my inner voice is still just as obnoxious, but I spend so much more of my time out of it.
I
And
see.
it's wonderful. And what that does is it opens up so much space in our lives to then start to really choose what we want in life. Who do we really want to be? What do we want to do? How do we want to spend our time? How do we want to show up for our friends or our family or our children or our dogs? I mean, it just opens up our autonomy in running ourselves.
Autonomy. I love that. You know, here's the other thing that's not so good about this conversation is that now I realize I have to go back to my wife and say, you're right again.
What do you mean?
Because that's what she does. She's so good at dismissing these kinds of things. And I always thought to myself, you have to deal with it head on. But she's right. She
That's funny because usually I feel
lives.
like from a gender perspective, it's usually the opposite. It's usually,
Yeah,
the guy
no.
that's like, oh, you're just, yeah.
No, she, I think she lives much more at peace with her life. But as I think about what you're saying, that's what she does. She just doesn't allow it into her space.
That's really interesting. People have been talking around this forever. Eckhart Tolle, Michael Singer, like you look at all of Buddha, Jesus. I mean, all of these people have always been talking around, get out of your mind. The mind is not safe, but it's so hard to go there if you believe you are your mind, if you believe it is protecting you. And that's where I think this new science really just shifts the whole game and suddenly gives so much validity to what these kind of, teachers have been telling us forever. Now I'm finally like, okay, I can buy in. And now I can fully believe what you're saying because
Fair
now I know
enough.
why.
But I'm just going to hide this podcast from my wife and leave it at that, okay?
Oh,
Because of the tribal mind. Okay, so one last question about affirmations. Do you have thoughts about the positive affirmations? Do you believe they work? Are they important for folks to do those sorts of things where they're, where they're speaking well of themselves? You know, I am successful. I'm whatever. I am happy.
if it works for you, great. Like,
Okay.
go ahead and do it. Think about it from the brain perspective. When you're saying, I am happy, you are choosing to say that. You are in your central
Oh,
executive and you
yeah.
are setting up essentially, you're kind of creating what clan norms you want the tribal brain to hear. So, from that perspective, yeah, I think they can be unbelievable because they can just shift you away from that negative voice.
Wow.
So if they work for you, keep doing them. They're awesome.
Wow. You know, I started this podcast, Betsy, probably a little year and a half ago. And and the turn of the new year, I was saying to myself, I really want to take it up a notch with the guests that I have on, And I'll tell you what, you made that happen here this morning, or not
I'm
this
so
morning, it's not
glad.
even morning, but you've done that here. And I appreciate that. Just, I love the way that you've incorporated both science and practicality, and the ideas that you're putting forward here. Really, there's things that I've learned here today that are just going to help me move forward in life, honestly. And I think that's going to be the same for my listeners. Where can people find you? your writings, you know, whatever it is, please take a minute to just promote.
So,
Use your
yeah.
tribal brain on this.
I am. So you can find me at my name. So it's BetsyHolmberg.com, BetsyHolmberg. And I'm terrible at social media. I'll tell you guys that because I hate it. And so I put everything on social media that I do. So I pitch everything like, hey, I've been on this podcast, but I don't spend tons
You
of
don't
time
spend
there.
time
So
there.
If you want to follow me, that would be wonderful. You'll see everything that I'm up to. But there won't be lots of extra content. And I'm just hoping to get a book out on this of specific case studies on depression, addiction, all of those things, so people can see themselves and the practical solutions for what to do. So hopefully that'll come out in a year or two. And
wow.
Yeah, there'll be more. So sign up for the newsletter and
please,
love to
yes,
keep the
I'm going to go do
conversation
that
going.
because I want to know when that book comes out. I will really look forward to it. Well, listen, thank you again so much for spending time and sharing. Really, you know, I mean, I look at people, you know, who have PhDs, and not just PhDs, but are either PhDs or put in the work of a PhD to study and research and then share all of this information with us. I'm very grateful for it personally, and I know my audience as well. So
it was such a pleasure to be here. Thank you,
thank you.
Kevin.
Thank you.